Tom, that's not my music. That's the theme to All Things Considered. That's not... Tom, you put on the wrong music.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bob. just a mistake. Hang on a second. I'll get your theme on. Here, wait.
Oh, that's better. Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm your host for Funny Stuff, a half-an-hour program of comedy presented here on KCRW. Tonight, we'll be listening to Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. Although it is only recently that Peter Cook and Dudley Moore have become known in this country, Dudley Moore through his starring roles in the films Ten and Arthur, and Cook through his regrettable television series The Two of Us, they have been major forces on the comedy scene in England for almost 20 years now. When they first met in 1960, when the cast of Beyond the Fringe was being assembled, Dudley Moore was a jazz musician and was used mainly for musical parodies in the show. Cook, however, was already an old hand at comedy, having written sketches for two successful London reviews, Pieces of Eight and One Over the Eight, both starring Kenneth Williams. One of these sketches was reprised in Beyond the Fringe, and it has been part of Cook and Moore's repertoire ever since. They even did it on Saturday Night Live. It's called One Leg Too Few, and it begins with a one-legged man hopping into a casting director's office.
Miss Rigby, Stella, my love, would you send in the next auditioner, please? Mr. Spigot, I believe it is. Mr. Spigot, please. Mr. Spigot?
Yes, Spigot. Spigot by name. Spigot by nature.
Good. Yes. remain motionless for a moment. Mr. Spigot, you are auditioning, are you not, for the part of Tarzan?
Right.
Now, Mr. Spigot, I couldn't help noticing, almost at once, that you are a one-legged person.
You noticed that?
When you've been in the business as long as I have, Mr. Spigot, you get to notice these little things almost instinctively. Now, Mr. Spigot, you, a one-legged man, are applying for the role of Tarzan.
Right.
A role that traditionally involves the use of a two-legged actor.
True.
And yet you, a unidexter, for the role.
Definitely.
A role for which two legs would seem to be the minimum requirement. Well, Mr. Spigot, need I point out to you where your deficiency lies as regards landing the role?
Yes, I think you ought to.
Need I say with overmuch emphasis that it is in the leg division that you are deficient.
The leg division?
The leg division, Mr. Spigot.
The leg division.
The leg division. You are deficient in it to the tune of one. Your right leg, I like your right leg. It's a lovely leg for the role. That's what I said when I saw it come in. I said, lovely leg for the role. Lovely leg for the role. I've got nothing against your right leg. The trouble is, neither have you. You fall down on your leg.
You mean it's inadequate?
It's inadequate, Mr. Spigot. And to my mind, at any rate, the British public is not yet ready. For the sight of a one-legged man swinging through the jungle. However, don't despair, Mr. Spigot. After all, you score over a man with no legs at all. I mean, should a legless man come in here demanding the role, I should have no hesitation in saying, get out, run away.
So there's still a chance?
There is still a very good chance, Mr. Spigot. If we get no two-legged character actors in here within the next 18 months, there is every chance that you, a uni-dexter, will be the very type of person we shall probably, in some way, be attempting at some time to contact telephonically. I'm sorry I can't be more definite, but you must understand what with all the difficulties of the VO process.
After the success of Beyond the Fringe in 1963, there was a period of about 2 years during which Peter Cook was a successful entrepreneur of comedy. One of his two projects was Private Eye, a satirical magazine which he helped to run and which is still a major force in England, although Cook no longer takes an active role. The other of his projects was a nightclub for live satirical comedy called The Establishment, which featured music by the Dudley Moore Trio. Dudley Moore is an accomplished pianist. Those of you who weren't aware, he actually was playing in the film, which one was it? 10. At about that time, the establishment started to falter, and Dudley Moore was asked to do a television special, and Moore asked Cook to join him. Cook wrote two sketches for the show, and one of them was the beginning of two characters they were to use throughout their career called Dud and Pete.
Come in here a moment, would you, please?
Here. You've been ferreting around in my sandwich box, haven't you?
I certainly have, and I found something not altogether connected with sandwiches. I refer, of course, to Blauvetter's Encyclopedia of Sexual Knowledge. How do you explain this?
I found it on the heath, Pete, and I thought I'd better keep in my sandwich to keep it dry, you know, until someone claimed it.
You'd be hiding it away, aren't you, because you're ashamed of it?
No, I haven't. I just kept it for safekeeping.
You shouldn't be ashamed of sex, Dad. It's no good hiding your sex away in your sandwich tin. That won't do any good. Bring it out in the open.
It's a good book,
there's
some good bits in it. Have you read any of it?
I've been through it up to page 3001.
Well, you've read the whole lot then, haven't you?
Yes, it's quite good, isn't it?
I like it, because it tells you everything about sex from the word go, doesn't it?
Well,
I
mean, it's a wonderful thing about a sexual mores throughout the ages, Dad.
And it shows you humans' sexual endeavour from the time of Adam and Eve, Pete.
It certainly does. All the myths about it as well. Mm. Of course, Adam and Eve, while they were in the Garden of Eden, they didn't have anything to do with sex to start with, you know. Weren't they in paradise, they didn't have anything to do with sex. Because they are wandering around naked, but they didn't know they were naked.
Oh, I bet they did know. I mean, you soon know once you get caught up on the brambles, wouldn't you?
No, they had no idea. They were remarkably stupid as well as naked, and they didn't know they were naked till up came the servant. Or no, rather the serpent.
Serpent, yeah.
Well, serpent in servant's guise, as some authorities have it. Yeah. Up came the serpent and said, here's an apple. Lay your teeth into that. And then they lay their teeth in the apple, and then the serpent said, you're nude. You're completely nude.
Hello, nudies.
Hello, nudies.
Of course, they dashed off into the brush and covered themselves with embarrassment, didn't they?
And, of course, mulberry leaves as well. They covered themselves all together with this primitive clothing made of leaves. And suddenly, as soon as they become completely covered, they began to get attracted to each other. Yeah. And then, of course, they tore off the mulberry leaves and it all started, the whole business.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, once you get clothes on, you're more attracted to other people. Like, I think Aunt Dolly's more attracted with clothes on than off. So Uncle Bert says, anyway.
Yes, well, Aunt Dolly is really at her most attractive when she's completely covered in wool and has a black veil over her, and ideally she should be in another room from you.
But who is your sort of ideal woman, Pete?
Well, above all others, I covet the elfin beauty. The gazelle slim elfin beauty. Very slim, very slender, but all the same, still being endowed with a certain amount of...
Busty substances.
Yes. A kind of Audrey Hepburn with Jane Mansfield overtones. That I go for.
Yeah.
for?
What do you like?
Me too, the same sort of thing. But actually, I like the sort of woman who throws herself on you and tears your clothes off with rancid sensuality.
Yes, they're quite good, aren't they? I think you're referring to rampant sensuality.
Well, either one will do. But, of course, the important thing is that they tear your clothes off.
That's the chief thing, whether it's rampant. I like a good rampant woman.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, a rampant woman or rancid, whichever you prefer. That was Veronica Pilbrow.
Oh, remember goodness,
her?
Yes, I remember her.
Remember
I remember her,
yeah. She always used to throw herself on Roger Braintree. Never me, though.
Yeah, well, Roger Braintree at school, he always knew much more than everyone else, didn't he? He's always boasting about the things he knew much more than anyone else.
Oh, clever draws, wasn't he?
Yeah. Remember that time he come round behind the wooden buildings?
Yeah.
And he had, what was his name?
Kenny Vair.
Kenny Vair with him. And he come up and told me, he said, "I've discovered the most disgusting word in the world. It's so filthy that no one's allowed to see it except bishops. And nobody knows what it means. It's the worst word in the world."
What was the word?
Well, he wouldn't tell me. I had to give him half a pound of peppermints before he let it out. Do you know what it was?
What?
Bastard.
What's that mean, Pete?
Well, he wouldn't tell me, so I knew it was filthy, but I didn't know how to use it. So he said the only place I could see it was down at the town hall in the enormous dictionary. They have the enormous one with a whole volume to each letter. And you can only get in with a medical certificate. So I went down there and sneaked in, you know, very secretively, and went up and I took down from the shelf this enormous, great, dusty bee and brought it down and opened it up, and there was the word in all its horror, bastard.
What was the definition, Pete?
It said bastard, child born out of wedlock.
What's a wedlock, Pete?
Wedlock, Dad, is a horrible thing. It's a mixture of a steam engine and a padlock. Some children are born out of them instead of the normal way, and it's the filthiest word in the world.
It'll make your hair drop out if
you say
it.
Oh, if you see that, yeah.
But I like looking words up in a dictionary. I like going down the Balanced Library, into the Reference Library, and getting out the Dictionary of Unconventional English out and looking up bloomers.
Yeah, quite a good way of spending an afternoon, I suppose.
Because I'll tell you what, Pete, actually, the whole business of sex is a bit of a letdown. Really, when you compare it with the wonderful romantic tales of the novelist who can portray sexual endeavours in so much better form.
Well, he makes it all so perfect. In the hands of a skilled novelist, sex becomes something which can never be attained in real life. Have you read Neville Shute?
Well, very little.
How much of Neville Shute have you read?
Nothing.
Yes, well, Shute is a master of sensuality. He has some wonderful erotic passages. There's Town Like Alice, which is a wonderful book, in the hardcover version, page 81. If you go down the library, it falls open at that page. It's a description set in Australia, Dad. And there's this ash blonde girl, Tina.
Tina, don't you be mean now.
Shut up. She's standing on the runway, you see, of this aerodrome. And it's very hot, Australian bush heat, and very hot indeed. And she's standing there waiting for her rugged Aussie pilot to come, bronzed Tim Bradley. And it's very hot. The cicadas are rubbing their legs together and making that strange... very similar to that ghastly noise which is coming from your mouth at this very moment. And it's very hot and she's covered in dust. The Australian dust is all over her. She's got dust on her knees, dust on her shoulders.
Dust on her bust, Pete.
Dust on her bust, as you so rightly point out, Dad. And she's very dusty and very hot. Hot and dusty, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, the clouds open. There's a tremendous clap of thunder, and suddenly the mongoose is on her. Tropical rainstorm is soaking through the frail poplin she's wearing, and as the dress gets damper and damper, damper and damper, her wonderful frail form is outlined against the poplin. And then, what does she hear? But in the distance, she hears a distant buzzing of an approaching plane. She cups her ear like this to hear that...
She cups her perfectly proportioned up thrusting ear, Pete.
Hollow Pete as well. Anyway, she cups it and the plane comes down, goes on a runway, comes to halt, and out comes the bronzed Aussie. But all the propellers are going very fast still. There's a tremendous rushing wind, and it blows up against her, and it blows the damp dress right up against her and reveals for all the world to see her perfectly defined...
Busty satchel.
Busty.
What happens after that, Pete?
Well, the bronze pilot goes up to her, and they walk away, and the chapter ends in three dots.
What do three dots mean, Pete?
Well, in suit's hands, three dots can mean anything, but...
How's your father, perhaps?
Usually means a bit of that, but suit always uses three dots. It means use your own imagination. Yeah. That's what it means. Conjure the scene up yourself. Whenever I see dots, I feel all funny.
Well, it's put me in the mood to go up the Balanced Library and look up bosom again.
No, it's no good looking up bosom. It only says... See bust.
It's nice to read it all again, isn't
it? Well,
it
gives you something to do, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
it's lovely. Right.
Anyhow, those characters were successful enough that that special became a series entitled Not Only But Also, which was extremely popular. The show was so successful and reportedly so good that when in 1967 the team went on to write and star in the marvelous little film Bedazzled, the only English-speaking country that the film did not do well in was Great Britain, because there it was felt the film was not up to the standard of these TV shows. Love to see them. Here's another example of the sketches from those shows in which Dudley Moore plays the father of Peter Cook.
Is that you, Brian?
Yes, Father.
What time of night do you call this thing?
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Father.
Oh, 4 o'clock in the morning, you, my boy. I've been sitting here since 11:30 wondering what's happened to you. I've been sitting here eating my heart out. I have to get up in 2 hours' time.
I know, Father.
I have to get up at 6:30. Where have you been?
Father, I'm 28 years old. Surely I'm old enough to go where I like, with whom I like, at what time I like. I was out with friends.
Friends? Friends? I call them fiends. They're nothing but a pack of whores.
The word is whore, Father, and then...
Yeah, you've become a regular little Rolling Stone ever since you opened that stupid little shop of yours.
There's nothing stupid about the boutique, Father. It happens to cater for modern trends, which you may be a little out of touch with, that's all.
Well, I thank the Lord I've lost contact with painted ties, kinky boots and PVC underwear. What sort of a bloody job is that then, eh? Wash my mouth out with soap and water. What I'd like to know is what's wrong with the drains then, eh? I've been down the drains all my life. My father before me's been down the drains, and my grandfather before me's been down the drains. The whole family's been down the drains for centuries.
Father.
I suppose you're too big to go down the drains, aren't you?
Father, the mere fact that our entire family tree grew in the drains is no reason why I should spend my life in the sewer.
If your mother was alive today, she'd have something to say about it. Oh, Rosie, Rosie. Why did you leave me, my darling, to cope with such an ungrateful son?
Don't drag Mother into it, please.
I can scarcely drag your poor mother into it when she's 5 foot underground, can I? How did we spawn this fop? You're all la-di-da, aren't you? You're too clever for your old father now, aren't you? Yes. Yes, of course you're too good for the drains, I forgot. You're a bloody marquis, aren't you? Oh, wash my mouth out with soap. Look here, my boy, I tell you, the drains are too good for you. That's what it is. I've seen better things than you floating down the drains.
Father, I don't know why you go on about the drains. You know perfectly well you retired at 31 and you haven't been down there since.
Oh, well, I haven't been down there since you, my boy.
Don't tap me with paper, Father.
Now then, Rosie, my darling, do you see what a popping jay we have for a son? What a strutting peacock? Did I fight in the war to hear you abuse me in such a way? Eh? Did I?
I've no idea, Father, if indeed you did fight in the war.
If indeed I did fight? Oh, if indeed I did fight you, my boy!
What's this then, eh? Tell me what this is. Tell me what that is then, go on.
That's your navel, Father.
Really? That's funny. I thought I contracted that on Dunkirk, on the beach, crawling on my hands and knees to preserve you, eh?
Father, if that's a war wound, I think you'll find I've got a similar one under my
shirt. I don't want to see under your shirt. I don't want to see under your shirt. You disgust me. You disgust me. I've been thoroughfare at St. Thomas's Beckentry for 45 years, and I've never seen you in that place. I've never seen you within 2 yards of its portal.
Father, I can't help being an agnostic. I wish I had faith like you.
Well, I wish I had faith like you. You, my boy. Now then. You come in here all hours of the morning, smelling of honey and flowers and reading your Poncy magazines and mixing your Bloody Marys, all soap and water. I've got a good mind to give you a good hiding. I've got a good mind to take my belt off to you.
I wouldn't do that, Father. Your trousers will fall down.
Very funny, very amusing, very witty. Oh, yes. Wouldn't have had that sort of cheek from you when you were a little boy. You're such a lovely little boy. My golden-haired beauty, you were. Your mother and I, we used to go along the cliffs at Westcliff, and she used to be on one side and I used to be on the other, holding your little warm, wet hands. And you used to see a ship on the horizon. You used to say, Daddy, what's that? And I used to say, it's a ship. You never ask me that anymore, do you? You don't have to ask me anything, do you, eh? Fancy pants. All you need to do is go strutting down the King's Road every Saturday afternoon, showing off to your fiends. Every word you say is a stab in the back. Every gesture, every look you make is a thorn in my side.
Father, there's no need for you to come down the King's Road too. I could do perfectly well without you.
Oh, perfectly well without you, my boy. Rosie, did we in our moment of joy spawn this werewolf, this Beelzebub?
I don't know why you keep looking upwards when you mention Mother. You know perfectly well she's living in Frinton with a sailor.
Terrible thing to say. That's a bloody terrible thing to say. Soap and water. Do you think my wife would have left me? Do you think your mother would have left me? She loved me as I loved her. Good Lord. Do you think your mother would have gone off to live with some dirty matelot in Frinton? She worshipped the ground I walked on.
She liked the ground, but she didn't care for you, Father.
Oh, she didn't care for you, my boy. Now then, she's got up there to the great sir in the sky, the biggest drain of them all. All you can do is make this place into a sin cellar. Yeah, you're nothing but a whore. You're a whore! Get out of my house. Get out of my house.
Father, it's not your house, it's my house.
Oh, pardon me for living. Pardon me for having two strong, sturdy legs to stand on. Well, get out of your house then. And never darken your doorstep again. Oh, get out.
I'm going to bed, Father. Why don't you have a Cydrax?
Oh, Rosie, my darling, my doll, my sweetheart. Where did we go wrong? Where did we go wrong?
Their television career in England continued on and off until 1972, when they decided to go back to the stage, mainly to reprise some of their best-known sketches. The review was called Behind the Fridge in England, and by the time it got to Broadway, where it was very successful, by the way, it was called Good Evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm talking tonight to Sir Arthur Greaves Striebling.
Oh, no, you're not.
I'm what?
You're not at all. You're talking to Sir Arthur Streeb Greebly.
Oh, I'm...
You're confusing me with Sir Arthur Greaves Striebling.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, well, my name is Streeb Greebling. The T is silent, as in fox.
I'm so sorry. I would like to ask Sir Arthur something about his rather unique restaurant, the Frog and Peach.
Well, this seems like an ideal opportunity, really. What with me being here and you being there.
Well, yes, yes.
Wonderful opportunity.
Yes, indeed.
Seize it.
Certainly will. Well, perhaps you would tell us something about the Frog and Peach, Sir Arthur.
Yes.
How, in fact, did the idea come to you?
The idea for the Frog and Peach came to me in the bath. A lot of things come to me in the bath. Many mosquitoes, various forms of water snake. But on this occasion, a rather unique and stunning idea. I suddenly thought to myself, where can a young couple with not too much money to spend, you know, feeling a bit hungry, a bit peckish, want something to eat, where can they go and get a really big frog? A really big frog and a damn fine peach. Where can they go?
Yes.
Where can they go? Of course, Answer came there none. So on this premise, I founded the restaurant.
On these premises, in fact?
On these precise premises, yes. I founded the Frog and Peach.
How long ago did you start this venture?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Certainly within living memory.
Good.
Believe it or shortly after World War II.
Ah, yes.
You remember that, World War II?
Well, certainly, yes.
Absolutely ghastly business.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely ghastly business.
Yes, indeed, yes.
I was completely against it.
Well, I think we all were.
Yes, well, I wrote a letter.
Getting back to the Frog and Peach.
Yes.
How has business been?
Let me answer that question in two parts. Business hasn't been, and there hasn't been any business. These last 35 years have been rather a lean time for us, up at the old F&P.
Well, don't you feel you're at a slight disadvantage being stuck out here in the middle of a bog and in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors?
I think the word disadvantage is awfully well chosen here, yes. This is what we're at. We're at a disadvantage. Mm. Stuck out here in the middle of a bog in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors. But I thought at the time, rightly or wrongly, possibly both, the people in this country were crying out for a restaurant without a parking problem. And here in the middle of a bog in the heart of the Yorkshire Moors, there is no problem parking the car.
No.
A little difficulty extricating it, but the parking here is magnificent.
Yes.
It is magnificent parking.
Yes, indeed.
Wonderful parking.
But don't you feel you're also at a disadvantage with regard to your menu?
Oh, yes. Yes, we are at a tremendous disadvantage with regard to the menu.
Mm.
Have you seen it?
Very briefly.
That's the only way to see it. I mean, the choice is so limited. We have such a limited choice. There's only two main dishes to choose from. Now, what are they? Last, I should know this by heart after 35 years. Oh, yes, first of all, there is frog à la pêche. Frog à la pêche is basically a large frog covered in boiling Cointreau with a peach stuck in its mouth. It's one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. The only alternative to frog à la pêche is even worse. Pêche à la frog. Pêche à la frog, a peach is brought to your table by the waiter, again covered in boiling Cointreau.
The waiter?
Very often, yes. Very often the waiter is, alas, covered in boiling Cointreau. But the policy here is to aim the Cointreau at the peach.
Yes.
That's the policy.
Yes.
The peach is then sliced open down the middle to reveal, oh my God, about 300 squiggling black tadpoles. It is the most nauseating sight I have ever seen. It's enough to put you off your food.
Yes.
Which is a damn good thing, considering what the food is like.
Yes. Who does the cooking?
My wife. My wife does all the cooking, and luckily she does all the eating as well. She's not a well woman.
She's not a well woman?
She is not a well woman, no. And she very much resents having to go down the well every morning. to feed the frogs. She dislikes it intensely. We have to lower her, screaming on a rope. Holy Christ, she goes. Frogs don't like it either.
No.
Dreadful.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. But if you don't mind me saying, sir, it does seem to me as if the whole venture of the Frog and Peach has been a little disastrous.
Oh. Oh, I don't think I'd use the word disastrous, yeah?
No.
I think catastrophic will be nearer the mark. The whole thing has been a total failure and a huge catastrophe.
But do you feel you've learned from your mistakes?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I have learned from my mistakes, and I'm sure I could repeat them exactly.
Thank you, Sir Arthur Green Stevens.
Speak to you, Mr.
Thank you.
So since then, Cook and Moore have worked together only sporadically. They made a rotten movie called The Hound of the Baskervilles, which you should avoid. And the only other project they've done is a series of albums called Derek and Clive, three records which are utterly unplayable on the air. If I played anything from those records, this would definitely be my last show. I love them. They're gross-out humor. A lot of people I know whose opinions I trust really don't like them, but I think they're terrific. Anyway, let's hope that Cook and Moore work together in the future, and I've got a lot more of their stuff on records, and you can be sure that we will return to them for a later show in this series. Citing a source, a lot of this information from this program came from a book called From Fringe to Flying Circus, Celebrating a Unique Generation of Comedy by Roger Wilmutt. Those of you who are fans of British comedy should try and get it, although, to the best of my knowledge, it's only available in Britain. If you write to me, care of the station, I can probably give you the address of the publisher. Anyway, tune in again next week for a program with Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And until then, this is your host, Bob Claster, saying to keep your sense of humor exercised, because you never know when you'll need it. Thanks a lot. Good night, everybody.